It's the 10th of June 2011, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Who would win in a fight between PZ Myers and Richard Dawkins? Are changes to computer operating systems putting us at risk of government tyranny? And will they finally explain how a spider can play solitaire? Has Fukushima fucked up the German nuclear program? If Nick Clegg was a musical, would he be looking for a brain, a heart, or a conscience? If you don't wash for 40 days, is that science, or will science not want to go anywhere near you? And can we predict what will be in next week's Daily Mail, or is hateful bile slightly more nuanced than this? But first, what is Richard Dawkins saying now about the new College of the Humanities, and will you have to pay £18,000 to hear him say it? You surely can't have failed to miss the almighty shitstorm this week surrounding the new College of the Humanities, which was unveiled as a private college headed up by philosopher A.C. Grayling. It's going to offer University of London degrees, and it's going to be led by 14 celebrity academics, including the likes of A.C. Grayling himself and Richard Dawkins. Here's the catch, though. The fees are going to be £18,000 a year, twice that of a normal university. They say that a week is a long time in politics, and I guess this week is an excellent example. This time last week, we all thought A.C. Grayling was a kindly philosopher and maybe like a cuddly granddad-type figure. But now this week, his critics aren't entirely sure. To cut a long story short, basically Grayling has clegged it. So over the last week, there's been protests. An event Grayling was involved in at Foyles was smoke-bombed, and last night, an event hosted by the British Humanist Association, in which Richard Dawkins and PZ Myers were in conversation, was briefly hijacked by protesters. We were there at the event itself recording it, so you can hear a full podcast of the actual talk on our website at poddelusion.co.uk, or on the Pod Delusion Extra feed. Also on our website, you can see a video of the protesters occupying the stage and kicking up a right fuss. This wasn't the end of it, though, as towards the end, one member of the audience used the Q&A section as an opportunity to ask Professor Dawkins to back out of supporting the new college. And I believe what we have is an exclusive recording of just what Dawkins had to say about his involvement.
I just have a request to Richard Dawkins.
Oh.
And I hope that, as a humanist, where we all believe in welfare and human fulfilment to be the aim of our morality, and also that no one should enjoy privileges or suffer discrimination because of any sort of beliefs, that you would use your position of power to please campaign so that everyone has access to humanities education and to not support the new College of Humanities. Thank you.
I would be delighted to support free education for everybody, and that's, I think, an ideal which we all of us should aspire to, and the parties for which I voted for would want that. However, we live in a world where that isn't happening. We live in a world where the government is clearly cutting off support for education. Now, I was educated at Oxford, and I loved it. The tutorial system, the one-on-one tutorial system, was, insofar as I had a making, it was the making of me. If I'm invited to support an enterprise that tries to increase the number of people who can enjoy that system at a time when it's being cut off, I would support that. Now, the true cost of educating a student, certainly at Oxford or Cambridge, is approximately £18,000, which is double the cap that the government has put on student fees. How do Oxford and Cambridge get away with it? They get away with it by subsidizing students using their ancient wealth from medieval endowments and so on, and in the case of Oxford, from Oxford University Press, which is a very successful business. So the true cost of educating a student, in the Oxbridge manner at least, is £18,000. The Anthony Grayling Initiative is a private enterprise initiative, and it's an attempt to, as it were, sidestep the government cuts by offering the same kind of education to those who can afford it, plus there's plans for in building up an endowment to provide bursaries and scholarships for those who cannot. afford it. I have also been inspired by the idea of being asked to give lectures on science to non-science students. I love the idea of teaching science. That's one thing that Oxford and Cambridge, as far as I know, don't do. So I'm thoroughly in favour of that. Now, when you look at the actual cost, that £18,000, it's, of course, a lot by the standards of any student. But it's not a great deal when you compare it with the sorts of things that people spend their money on, rich people spend their money on anyway. And we, like it or not, we do live in an economy, we live in a political system where some people are richer than others, and it's unfortunate, but it's true. And you might as well, if you want to picket Antony Grayling's new university, you might as well picket anybody who owns a car that's sort of above average price. You might as well picket anybody who has a... Sorry? Well, I got a government... In those days, one got government grants. Yeah.
I think that...
I would love it. I would love it if the government, through taxation, paid for free education for everybody. But it's not happening.
An interesting response, I'm sure you'll agree. We'll hopefully be exploring the issues surrounding this in future episodes of The Pod Delusion. So if you've got an opinion, why not post it in the comments on our website at poddelusion.co.uk. Or, of course, you can post them on my new Elite Pod Delusion website, which is only available for paying members. It's £1,000 an episode. But don't worry, if you are poor, if you try really hard and are really exceptional, we might let you in free, if we're feeling very kind indeed. But anyway, let's not lose focus. The event itself was being held because of the other man there, PZ Myers. PZ is an American biology professor who isn't the biggest fan of religion. As he's not over here very often, we couldn't resist the opportunity to have a quick chat with him. I started by asking what exactly he was doing here in the UK.
Oh, well, there's... why am I here? That's a good question. I got dragged over here for the World Atheist Conference in Dublin. And as long as I was here, I figured, hey, I flew all that way, I'm going to get my money's worth and I'll check out a bunch of things.
And tonight you're in conversation with Richard Dawkins as part of an event organised by the British Humanist Association.
Yes, I'm kind of wondering how this will turn out. Richard and I talked a little bit about it in Dublin, and we mainly felt like, man, we agree on everything. So, you know, if you're coming here expecting some sort of, you know, steel cage match with chairs thrown at each other, I don't think it's going to happen. But we'll see. We'll see. We're kind of hoping that maybe the audience members will pull up some questions that sow dissension among us.
Richard Dawkins has been in the news this week because he's part of the new College of the Humanities. Given it's supposed to be sort of a more American style of university, not that it could be called a university yet, I was wondering whether you think it might work or if you've got any...
It works in the United States, so you know I can see it working here. And I am very appreciative of the goals that Grayling has set for it. Mm. But at the same time, I kind of understand how students would be getting upset at the price of tuition going up. And here's, you know, it's like it's a ratchet that's gone up just a little farther now. But what I think should be happening is that the students ought to be turning out and protesting not Antony Grayling and not Richard Dawkins and not this new university. They ought to be protesting the university at their members of parliament and getting very upset about the fact that government isn't funding education as it should. Education should be free. Everyone should get an education. So I think the way we will solve this problem is if the government steps in and covers the tuition costs for everybody who attends a new university. Then we're done.
I couldn't agree more with that. Also, one of the other goals of this university, it's got there's modules on things like critical thinking and sort of understanding of the scientific method as well for humanities students. Uh-huh. You're a teacher in your day job. What sort of challenges are there when communicating?
Yeah, I can tell you, as somebody who has designed a first-year curriculum for biology majors, that it's kind of the problem in reverse. We felt when we put our courses together that we needed that critical thinking element, so we need people thinking about the science and how it's done. We're actually sort of following Grayling's vision right now, in that my our introductory biology course is full of philosophy and history.
Mm.
Because we think that's really important for understanding what's going on. For too many years, we've had students go through these programs where it's memorize a reference book, and they don't learn. That's not how you learn. That's how you memorize crap, and that's not good.
Well, one of the things I think you commented on your blog was about the Uncaged Monkey tour that we had here with our rock star physicist. And I think you mentioned that you'd like to see something the same in the U.S. What would be your rock star panel of scientists?
In the United States, let's see, I would... Oh, definitely Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is simply phenomenal. Mm. What the catch is they've got to be a scientist and they've got to be media savvy, and that's a tough one to find. I like Phil Plait. He's a personal friend of mine. He's an astronomer. What about biologists? We need an American biologist who... Oh, that's got to be me. Okay. Yeah, I'll do the tour. Yeah, and then, you know, there's something else. I hate to say this, but I think we've got to do more of it. And let's bring in more media people to this business. Mm. Here in the UK, you do it better than we do. I mean, you've got like Robin Ince, who's not a scientist, but he's personable and he's entertaining and he understands the ideas and he gets them across. And we don't have very many of those. We may have to import them. Yeah, we will steal Robin from you and bring him over. Oh,
do you think there'd be the same sort of appetite for such a tour in America? Because here, the tour was phenomenally successful. Thousands of tickets were sold really quickly.
Yes.
Do you think the Americas would react the same way?
I think they would. And again, it's why I said we need more of the media types to get involved. I think the closest thing we've got to it in the U.S. right now is the amazing meeting, TAM, with James Randi, which tries very hard to be entertaining as well as informative and does it in exotic places like Las Vegas where, yeah, it's yes, we need science with showgirls and showboys because we're not going to be sexist about this.
As a tool for science communication, because a lot of the things that we have over here, discussions, are about science communication, do you think that kind of approach would work to kind of educate the wider American audience? Because there's always seems to portray a tension between science and other elements in the U.S. about
yes,
science.
That there's conflict with religion, among other things, and our religiosity quotient is much higher in the United States. But yeah, we need a couple of approaches. We need things that make science more entertaining, and then we need a body of easily accessible but perhaps more serious science discussions that people can attend. We had Chautauquas for a long time in the United States. We still do. I personally run something called Café Scientifique, which you have over here as well, and it draws out some community members. And when you get right down to it, science is surprising and fun and enjoyable, and people find this out when they hear about it.
We will let you prepare, because I'm sure there's lots of thinking that needs to... I don't know.
I don't know. In some ways, you know, this kind of feels like my PhD final oral. Only it's public, and it's Richard Dawkins interrogating me. I think it's going to be a friendlier conversation than that. But you know, I get these kind of butterflies in my stomach about this. You know, I could fail up here, and they'll revoke my PhD or something. This will settle who is the emperor of the atheists.
Please. Thank you very much.
You can hear the podcast of the full talk, protesters and all, at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, this week was the Apple Worldwide Developers Conference. Essentially, every year, Apple gather together technology journalists from around the world to tell them what ideas they've stolen from other companies for the latest version of their own operating system. And this time, it was no exception, with the unveiling of iOS 5. What's interesting, though, is not what's happening now, but where this sort of operating system might lead in the future. Here's Pete Haig, terrifying us with more.
Recently, there's been speculation among certain technology commentators that Apple is going to abandon their desktop operating system in favour of their smartphone operating system. Such speculation isn't new, as it seems a lot of people think this is the direction that Apple has been going in for a few years now. To me, this is part of a larger trend. The iPhone operating system, imaginatively titled iOS, has led to the seemingly unstoppable march of the walled garden system, where a device only runs software supplied and maintained through its manufacturer's app store. This allows the manufacturer to take a cut of the software developer's profits, subsidising the hardware itself and making it cheaper to the consumer. And, more critically, it allows the manufacturer to dictate what software is run on the device. This has been the source of some fairly well-known complaints that I won't get into here. What I want to talk about here is the wider consequences of this trend. The walled garden model is insanely popular, and for most users, looks set to displace more conventional general-purpose operating systems like Windows and macOS in the next decade or so. The last widely used general-purpose operating system is likely to be GNU Linux, which is not likely to increase its share of users in a world where people flock to the walled garden. This trend is a very bad thing, in my humble opinion, because it opens the very real possibility of these general-purpose operating systems becoming illegal or restricted at some point in the future. I know this sounds far-fetched, but bear with me. A general-purpose operating system, even one that is considered non-free itself, will at the moment run any correctly constructed program you tell it to, without forcing you to go through the manufacturer first. This includes programs that violate copyright, initiate denial of service attacks, and attempt to crack Wi-Fi passwords. Using such an operating system doesn't necessarily mean you're going to do any of these things, but you can do them, and once you are running such an operating system in the privacy of your own home, there is little anyone can do to stop you. Most people who use general-purpose operating systems do not use them for criminal acts, just as most people, outside of war zones, who own guns do not use them for criminal acts. Both of these things can be used for criminal acts, and there is no way for the state to tell what they are going to be used for before the act in question occurs. Now, guns are almost entirely illegal in the UK, and almost entirely legal in the US. This is because gun owners are a tiny minority in the UK, and easy to legislate against, whilst gun owners in the US are a significant portion of the population whose voting power must be respected by their politicians. At the moment, the operating system is in the same position as the handgun is in the US. Far too many people own them and use them legitimately for any move to ban them to be seriously considered. However, looking forward a decade or so, to when almost everybody uses a walled garden system exclusively, we move to a situation closer to gun ownership in the UK. Then comes the ban. I imagine many of you are still sceptical. Try and cast your mind forwards and think how a public used to exclusively walled garden systems would react to scare stories about online identity theft and so-called cyber terrorism, a term invented by those who wanted to smudge the moral distinction between launching a denial of service attack and blowing yourself up on a crowded train. If such a threat was overplayed, as threats often are by the media, then fingers would immediately point at those who used general-purpose operating systems, who ran code on their computers without any kind of government or corporate oversight. John Smith on the street may well think, I can get by fine with my iOS device, so everybody should be able to. Those weirdos with their Linux operating system must be up to something. From the Gin Act to the Public Order Act 1994 to the Digital Economy Act, it has always been a vote winner for politicians to legislate against behaviour that sits outside strict, middle-of-the-road social norms, especially when doing so is in the interests of industry. And I believe we face a real threat of this happening in the not-too-distant future. I would ask everybody to read Richard Stallman's essay, The Right to Read. I've asked James to include a link to it on the Pod Delusion website. This is Pete Haig, stoking up nerd paranoia for the Pod Delusion.
This next report by Drew Ray is in response to an email I sent out to our contributors the other day, simply asking, what are we running out of? It turns out that we're running out of rather a lot of things. I guess this means that at least we're not going to run out of things to worry about. Here's Drew with more.
Have you ever noticed that most epics and tales of high fantasy have a long backstory filled with wise and glorious past civilizations? The Lord of the Rings is set at the end of the Third Age of Middle-earth, featuring heroes armed with ancient magical weapons, trying to destroy an ancient artifact of power. The Deathly Hallows in the Harry Potter movies are items more powerful than modern wizards can create. Even Captain Carrot of the Terry Pratchett Discworld novels wields a uniquely non-magical sword handed down through generations of lost kings. Collapsed civilizations are a feature of our own universe as well. It would be denying historical pattern to claim that our current civilization, even, is immune from collapse. Perhaps the best-known recent examination of this is the book Collapse by Jared Diamond. The themes in this book are more controversial than those in his more successful Guns, Germs, and Steel. And like many good storytellers of history, it's sometimes hard to differentiate between his own take on things and a genuine consensus historical view. One of the key features of civilization collapse discussed by Diamond is resource depletion. The classic illustration of this, with my own disclaimer that the factual basis is disputed, is over-exploitation of Easter Island and the devastation of the civilization that built those cool stone heads. So, what are we as a civilization in danger of depleting and running out of? A quick Google search gives the following list of recent concerns. We are in grave danger of running out of IPv4 internet addresses. We are in serious danger of running out of helium. We are in serious danger of running out of fair trade chocolate. We are even in serious danger of running out of enough wind to power the UK wind farms. The biggest concern, of course, is peak oil. Peak oil is the point where the amount of oil we are able to pull out of the ground each year stops increasing and starts decreasing. Because the rate of oil extraction fluctuates, we won't reliably know when we've hit peak oil until sometime after we actually hit it, and the rate of decrease could be quite rapid from that point. One of the frustrating aspects of peak oil is that we don't have any good scientific way of knowing how much oil there is. This is the same with most resources. We know how much we have found, and we know the historical rate of finding things. Typically, our past estimates of how much there is have been pessimistic because new technology has caused a step change in our ability to find or to exploit resources. There are some things that we know for sure we're not running out of. Lithium, for example. Compared to how much lithium the world uses, we've got plenty. Go crazy with lithium. Ditto, despite the scare stories, we're not running out of helium either. You can probably inflate all the party balloons you want. For most minerals, including the key example of uranium, we currently are aware of enough of the mineral to last us for between 80 and 100 years. Resources that we know about and are confident of extracting are called reasonably assured reserves, and ones that we're fairly sure about are called inferred reserves. For most minerals, we have about 80 years of reasonably assured reserves, and between 20 and 50 years' worth of inferred reserves. The rate of prospecting for reserves tends to match the demand for the resources, so the exhaustion date keeps marching comfortably ahead of us as we use up the resource. Logically, this can't happen forever. We know the processes by which resources are created and transformed, and we certainly use things up faster than they're created. There will eventually come a time when one of the shortage scares turns out to be true. When that happens, our descendants will look back and think, how could those people have been so stupid as to ignore the warning? The simple answer is that none of the warnings have been true yet, and so we spuriously apply inductive reasoning and rely on the fact that none of them will ever be true. There was once a man who fell off the Empire State Building. As he passed the 10th floor, he was heard to say, "Well, I'm doing fine so far." We are that man, but it would be nice to see a sign on the floor telling us which floor it is that we're currently going past. This is Drew Ray for the Pod Delusion.
Some time ago, news of Germany giving up its nuclear programme would have been met with cheers by the rest of the world. But as we've moved on from tired references to the war, the reaction instead is one of bemusement, as it's off the back of the Fukushima disaster that Germany has decided to get rid of its entire nuclear industry. It's a bit like the time they had that baby, but then threw it out because the bathwater got a bit manky. So, what exactly is going on? Here's Sven Rudloff with more.
News from Germany. Our conservative liberal coalition government suddenly doesn't like nuclear power anymore. For the next decade, Germany plans to close all of its nuclear reactors and to boost renewables even more than originally planned. All of Germany? Well, before I continue, I need to put out two conflict of interest announcements and one disclaimer. First, for the past 10 years, I have worked for the Germany-based utility E.ON, which has stakes in about half of the German nuclear plants and operates about a third of them. While I worked for E.ON in the UK, I looked after conventional generation. This is coal, gas and nuclear plants. Since my return to Germany, I have worked in E.ON's renewable business. So I know quite a bit about the technologies involved and about both the UK and the German energy market. Second, I'm a psychologist and currently do PhD research on the role of emotions in how we perceive risks. So while I certainly do not welcome the recent incidents at the Fukushima nuclear reactors, you may understand that the world's and especially Germany's reaction to those incidents is very interesting for me from a scientific perspective. So the disclaimer needs to be, all of this is my personal evaluation and opinion. I'm certainly not speaking on my employer's behalf, neither for its nuclear nor for its renewables business. That out of the way, here are the facts. About 40 commercial nuclear reactors have been built in Germany since the 1960s, of which 17 are still operational today. For a long time, Germany had a reputation for state-of-the-art nuclear research, engineering, and operational experience. There has never been any significant nuclear incident in Germany. Nuclear provides for about a quarter of Germany's power production. The rest heavily relies on coal and even lignite plants, while gas plants play a minor role. This is a key difference to the UK, where gas is already big and coal very much on the decline. One of the reasons is that the German coal and lignite mining industry have been protected far longer than the UK one, while the UK saw a rush for gas on the back of its former reserves in the North Sea. From the political side, German conservatives and liberals have basically always supported nuclear, while the Green Party actually grew out of the anti-nuclear movement of the 1970s. The Social Democrats have been sitting on the fence for a long time. In 2000, the Green Party had finally got into power as part of a coalition government with the Social Democrats. This was when long-term Chancellor Helmut Kohl was succeeded by Gerhard Schröder. At this point, the Greens pushed for the so-called nuclear consensus between the government and the power plant operators. The consensus became law in 2002 and states that no new nuclear plants will be built in Germany, and that the existing reactors are only allowed to generate a specific amount of power during their remaining lifetime. Under this consensus, the last German nuclear plant would have been closed in 2021. Fast forward 10 years, and the Conservatives and Liberals are in power again. In the autumn of 2010, Angela Merkel announced the so-called lifetime extension, which would allow the remaining nuclear plants to run 12 years longer than under the consensus, with the last one closing in 2033. One of the key arguments for the lifetime extension was that nuclear was seen as a reliable, low-carbon bridging technology that would be required until renewables can provide for all demand, and that this was unlikely to be feasible by 2021. The opposition and large parts of the public were furious, as they regarded this as a sellout to the nuclear operators. Also, Merkel tried to design the law in a way that would not require her to seek the approval by the Council of the Federal States, which she was unlikely to get, considering the existing majorities. But not all was well for the utilities either. In exchange for the lifetime extension, they were obliged to both pay into a renewables development fund and also to pay an additional nuclear fuel tax, which would bring the government 2.6 billion euros every year until 2016. Since the announcement of the lifetime extension, several things have happened. First, some of the German federal states went to court to have the legality of the lawmaking process investigated. Second, public opposition to other large infrastructure projects grew in Germany, especially regarding the demolition of the historic train station and surrounding areas in Stuttgart, the capital of federal state Baden-Württemberg. This in turn led to ever-decreasing popularity of the Conservatives and Liberals and increasing popularity of the opposition, especially the Green Party. Then Fukushima happened. Everyone was shocked. The opposition cried, "Told you so," with regards to the risks of nuclear. The public went even more against the government, and the Green Party claimed the federal state of Baden-Württemberg in elections, ending a conservative reign that had lasted for decades. The only way for Merkel to win back some sympathies was to make a complete U-turn on nuclear. She immediately ordered the 7 oldest German reactors to be turned off, plus another one who was in maintenance at the time. This was announced as a temporary measure for 3 months, while the safety of all reactors should be investigated by one commission, and while another so-called ethics commission should discuss the ethical implications of nuclear power and make a recommendation about its future use in Germany. Funny enough, this ethics commission did not include particular nuclear experts, but indeed parties deemed proficient in ethical questions, including the churches. Merkel did not want to make the mistake again to be seen as being bought by the industry. However, at least the commission invited people like E.ON CEO to give their view in forms of testimonies. After a very rushed process to define changes for about 6 major laws and some negotiations with the federal states, the German government's current plan is as follows. The 8 nuclear reactors that had been temporarily turned off shall never be turned on again. The remaining 9 will be closed in defined batches, with the last one closing in 2021. So we are essentially back to the nuclear consensus of 2000. However, with 2 major differences. Now there is much less flexibility in the actual closure dates, and the government still expects the operators to pay the additional nuclear fuel tax, which was introduced alongside the previous lifetime extension. Because half of the 17 reactors are already shut down, this tax will now only amount to about 1.3 billion euros per year instead of the original 2.6 billion. But still, the operators are expected to pay for a lifetime extension they never got. While the utilities do not want to work against the public's will regarding a nuclear phase-out, they are still obliged by their shareholders to ensure proper financial compensation. For example, the Chancellor's order to simply shut down the 8 reactors was legally unfounded. Only if there had been specific security concerns for any given reactor, such an order would have been legal, but this is not the case. Also, the operators now threaten to go to court over the nuclear fuel tax, as the lifetime extension effectively does not take place. On both accounts, the chances are not too bad, and I kind of expect government and operators to find some agreement. This is, however, just the financial side. Fact is, Germany will go nuclear-free by 2021. Again. Is this feasible? Well, sure, Germany can live without nuclear, but it will have consequences. Without nuclear, Germany at times needs to import more power from its neighbors, including nuclear power from France. More importantly, German coal plants will need to run more to cover the loss of nuclear capacity. And some already foresee a new generation of German coal and even lignite plants. I just hope more gas plants will be built quickly. In any case, this will lead to more CO2 emissions, making it more difficult for the EU to reach its overall CO2 targets. This increases the price of CO2 certificates, and this in turn increases electricity prices for everyone. This may not have a massive impact on private customers, but definitely on Germany's industry, which is still heavy on steel, chemicals and manufacturing. Also, Germany's electricity grid is already strained, with lots of onshore wind in the north and main demand in the south. With the nuclear plants, the grid operators lose a large amount of reserve power to balance the grid. I don't expect major blackouts, but this adds to the need for large-scale grid enhancements due to more renewables. And this during a time where a NIMBY attitude is more widespread than ever. Finally, it is laudable that the government not only wants to shut down nuclear, but at the same time tries to change other provisions to accelerate the development of renewables. However, projects like offshore wind parks cost billions of euros and require experience in large-scale construction projects. Guess who are the ones who actually undertake these kind of projects? Large international utilities. Using the money from the nuclear fuel tax to plug holes in the federal budget may seem straightforward to the government, but it's also money the German utilities then don't have to invest in German renewables. In summary, I believe that Germany can survive without nuclear, but nevertheless, this latest U-turn was mostly emotion and opinion-driven, without proper regard to all of its consequences. I will continue to watch the developments closely. This is Sven Rudloff, alias Yoxotot, for the Pod Illusion.
Now, as much as I love talking about electoral reform and constitutional politics, before yesterday, I'd have thought that it's very difficult to jazz them up. They're inherently boring topics. You can't make a song or a dance about them, can you? However, I changed my mind when a new musical made me think differently. Nicked is a musical charting the rise and fall of Nick Clegg since the last election, and is currently trying to get into a theatre in London following its debut in Ipswich earlier this year. Thinking about it actually makes some sense. I mean, I guess both theatre and Clegg have a natural affinity, as both are well known for being represented by having two completely opposite faces. Yesterday, they gave a showcase performance, so our deputy editor Liz Luckendorf and I went down to see it, and we can report that it was actually amazing. It was well researched, the chronology was on, and I guess the songs and dances were pretty good too. So afterwards, we had a chat with Sam Hodges, who both produced the show and plays the role of David Cameron. I started by asking him how it all got started.
Well, it's been a project in development for about 6 months. It started off at the Theatre 503 in Battersea. This is a 20-minute piece by the quite brilliant writer Richard Marsh, who's actually a performance poet, and he teamed up with a kind of hip-hop singer-songwriter by the name of Rogue Nouveau, and they were commissioned to just do a coalition piece, a response to the government as a coalition themselves. That was a kind of 20-minute play, and then High Tide, company that I run, commissioned a full-length version of the musical. So over the last, I don't know, 3-4 months, we've been madly writing songs. I mean, anyone who works in musicals will tell you 4 months is not enough. So it's been quite a hectic schedule. In fact, midway through the run in High Tide, which is in Suffolk, 2 songs were scrapped on night 4, rewritten, and we learnt them that morning, learnt the choreo. So it's been a pretty intense schedule. But so today is the idea is to kind of show it to as many people as possible and see if we can bring it to London or elsewhere, Suffolk being relatively far away.
So the musical itself sort of tells Clegg's story from the election up until literally only a month ago.
That's right. I mean, it's been a very interesting process for that reason. I mean, it's obscenely topical, almost over topical at times. And the show, the first half, is the formation of the government. The 5 days that we, the electorate, had to wait while they worked themselves out, culminates obviously with the coalition being formed. And the second half is really the kind of decline of Clegg over the last year. I would argue quite a kind of sympathetic depiction. I don't know what you thought. Certainly kind of a relatively tragic one. And the interesting process was that when we performed it in Suffolk, it was that week the referendum. So prior to the referendum itself, the audience had 2 options. They voted which way it would go. And then obviously after the rather predictable result came out, it went one way. But that meant that in that moment, it was unbelievably poignant, actually. That there was one show when the results came in 10 minutes before the end of the show, and we incorporated it in. It's very exciting.
You mentioned the sympathetic performance of Clegg. The first thing we said after it all finished was, that's the first time we've felt sorry for Clegg in a very long time.
Right, absolutely.
But the one thing that really did impress me, I don't really understand the theatre. I'm not very cultured like that, but I'm a big politics nerd, and I really thought you've clearly done your homework.
To give credit where it's due, the writer has done a hell of a lot,
yeah.
and was able to speak to various members actually involved in the negotiations, so got a lot of inside information, but also I think he is himself very sympathetic to Clegg's plight, and so inevitably, as part of any show, there was a bit of fiction, the kind of behind closed doors, and I think that's probably what's most interesting to audiences, seeing what's not presented to us, the kind of politics, the personal drama, Clegg with his wife, you know, David as well, seeing those dynamics. We know so little about Miriam Dorentes, you know, she's very unpublic, to her credit, but clearly a very kind of important, strong woman in Clegg's life.
Mm.
So yeah, I mean, I think we've got very into it over the last few months, and have found ourselves all with stirrings for Clegg, although I have to admit, personally, getting into Cameron's head, I mean,
it happens to be a scary place to
be. It's a scary place to be. I mean, it's I'm in a very weird situation, and I don't know whether to say this, but I found myself drawn to the guy. I mean, he's incredibly kind of charismatic and clever, and actually the way that he has manipulated the course of events over the last few months, and that's what we tried to bring out, that actually, as much as Clegg's own doing, it was Cameron and his buddies who managed to, all the important situation, you know, like when the tuition fees was announced and things like that, he was nowhere to be seen. And he was very tactical.
That really surprised me. When you were doing the coalition negotiations, I read David Laws' book when it came out, so I thought the chronology was perfect. The Gordon Brown was just barking down the phone and not listening. But what did surprise me was I actually learned about the trade-off for the university announcement for Dalian Alexander's promotion.
The Osborne ultimatum.
Yeah, that was brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, that is a kind of fictional reconstruction of what might have happened behind closed doors. It's fairly kind of plausible as a bit of fiction, and I think certainly what we saw was that David Willetts, who's a much less recognisable figure than the rest of the Conservatives who we're used to, was the only one out there with Cable and Clegg who were taking all the stick off the public.
So where are you hoping the musical will go from here? Have you thought about, say, going into coalition with another musical in order to get onto the...
Very good question. We haven't thought about that. I'm not quite sure how that would work. I think we want something to happen. The question is where it goes, and I think one of the big things that we've been discussing is it's so ultra topical that maybe it needs to develop beyond that, and that actually it needs to become what it almost is, which is a story, a personal story of political hubris, you know, of a politician, his rise and fall, effectively, you know. A year ago, a little bit over a year ago, Clegg kind of exploded onto our television screens, and really we didn't know much about him. A year later, almost to the day, he kind of goes up in smoke. I mean, who knows, you know, who knows what's going to happen next? And I suppose there's a temptation, do you keep rewriting? Do you keep adapting? The fear with that is it becomes a bit of a review show. And actually, I think what's interesting is there's something almost kind of Greek tragedy about the story as it is. And if we can develop it into a story that works on its own, that doesn't rely on it being absolutely today, then it could work.
Brilliant. And of course, as any more developments with the show happen, we'll keep Pod Delusion listeners updated so they can hopefully come and see the show.
So,
Sam Hodges, thank you very much.
Lovely to speak to you.
Thank you. Whilst the show still isn't in the theatre, we'll let you know when it is, and you can find a link to a video preview on the Pod Delusion website. Now, with most reports on the Pod Delusion, we sort of assume that you know not to try them at home. After all, if you put on a musical about Nick Clegg in your front room, you'll probably look pretty mental. But with this next report, I feel the need to explicitly flag it up. Don't try this at home, as otherwise, things are going to get a whole lot stinkier. I'll let James Thomas explain.
Smelly Tweet, a personal diary. About a month ago, I was trawling through my Twitter feed when I spied an invitation from Guerrilla Science to take part in a bit of an odious experiment. No, this was not a recreation of Milgram, Tuskegee or Little Albert, but a slightly less offensive test of the morals, if not of the olfactory nerves. It stated that, "We cordially invite all with a partiality for putridity to join us as we investigate what it means to be dirty, and to attempt to last 40 days without a wash. Now, this is to tie in with the Wellcome Trust's dirt season, and there is a prize of a ticket to the Secret Garden Party Festival, although, to be honest, I'm not that bothered. I mean, I love free stuff, but what I was really interested in was the science behind what was going to happen to me and to my brain. I would not be too offended if my friends were to claim that my relationship with soap and water was marked by long periods of estrangement, or that my claims of a natural resistance to gastric parasites was born of an early and prolonged exposure to nematodes ingested from mucky hands. But 40 days of no washing, apart from my hands, but of anything else, including my teeth and my hair? Luckily, I have no job to go to at the moment. And I get to describe every last sweaty, oily, flaky umscar to my adoring public on Twitter. It comes no surprise that I jumped at the chance. And the fools accepted. I was sent a pristine white t-shirt, which I was to wear, having abluted myself thoroughly on the night before the start of the experiment. Duly warm and fuzzy after a nice, hot and long bath, I tried to slink into my nightwear, only to discover it was a medium fit. Now, for the purpose of clarity, I should point out that I'm an obese little fucker, and medium is less skin-tight, more subcutaneous. To be quite frank, I look like an overzealous mutated Frankfurter, and sleep was really hard to come by that night. The next morning, I cut myself out of my bondage, and packaged it as instructed to lay in my freezer for the next month and a bit. And then for the next few days, it was all fairly boring. I felt a bit greasy. Not brushing my teeth was a pain, but not too bad, to be honest, until I remembered that I was playing golf on Friday, and then going to see some golf on Saturday, and Sunday. And when Dad and I go to see the golf, we tend to walk the course a couple of times, talking bollocks about wind direction and stimp meters, and pretending we have a clue about what's going on. Now, any walkers among you know how bad a danger chafing is to fat people who have not washed, and despite expert advice from Mark Thomas the week before, by hole nine of the first trip around, I was in real pain. Red, stinging, I want my mummy and a bucket of pseudo-cream pain, and this proceeded to get worse over the course of the weekend. By Sunday night, I was able to read my Kindle by the pulsating red strobe from my inner thighs, and the stinging from my gluteal cleft, and yes, I have been wiping most carefully, felt as though I had fallen arse-first into a patch of nettles. Oh well, faint heart ne'er won fair Nobel Prize. At least I didn't actually have to meet anyone, really. Just keep a low profile and downwind. So when the British Science Association said they would really love to talk to me about an available post that was currently vacant, I was delighted and then conflicted. After all, I was doing this for science, not some transitory festival love-in. I mean, I really dig this stuff, you know? So everyone was giggling and telling me to wash and wishing me the best and bad luck on having to pull out. And I thought, bollocks to that. I'll ask the BSA what they thought, and my response was just one of a number of reasons why I would love to work for these guys. Because they were totally in with it, and I even joked that if the smell was too bad, we could hold the interview in the Natural History Museum gardens. So, interview went really well, and by next week's report I hope to be able to tell you I'll be joining the staff of the British Science Association shortly. But in the meantime, have a look at the links on the site, check out what Gorilla Science, the Wellcome Trust, and the British Science Association get up to, and with any luck, I will still be free to speak to you next week. This was James Stinky Thomas, reporting for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, we're going a bit Mystic Meg. Marsh has been regularly appearing on this programme, exposing instances of PR stories infiltrating the newspapers. But now he's got so cocky, he's going to actually predict what will be coming up soon. We'll check in with Marsh in a couple of weeks to see how he's done, and find out exactly how he did it.
It's been a while since I've popped up on this show, pulling apart bad news stories, where spurious copy from PR companies has ended up in the news. Perhaps all you lovely pod delusioners have taken my absence as a sign that things in the world of news and PR are all rosy, hunky-dory, and all sorts of other pleasant terms that end in nice fun Y sounds. Or perhaps you've just not noticed. Who knows? Well, if it were the former, I do apologise for giving the impression, because it's fair to say there's been no let-up in the slew of bilge poured by public relations into our willing and grateful press. In fact, to illustrate the point, I chose a random day this week, Tuesday in fact, and I dug my way through the Daily Mail, the PR delivery mechanism of choice, to see what I could identify as being bullshit survey derived. In order to maintain sanity, I gave myself 20 minutes as a limit. I barely needed that, I must tell you. Highlights included the environmental farming charity Leaf, who told us we're a nation of nature ninnies, coincidentally discovering our natural ignorance in the same week they announced their Open Farm Sunday events, which were designed to help people cure their ignorance of nature. Then, of course, there's the social networking site, which announced that Germans have no sense of humour, reporting, of course, not necessarily people's experiences of German humour, so much as their familiarity with that particular stereotype. What Sven Rudloff, the Pod Delusion contributor and fully-fledged German fella, has to say about that, I'm not sure, but I imagine he won't be amused. Top of the pile, though, had to be the exciting discovery that resisting the sugary treats we crave may make us feel worthy, but actually such worthy resistance is really bad for us. Apparently, a study of British women found that those who gave in to temptation on a regular basis, whatever that means, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, they were much happier than those who restrained themselves. Apparently, they even, in the Daily Mail, had a neuroscientist offering his expert opinion. It was proper science and everything. Except, of course, as even the Mail stated very openly, the study was in fact a survey of 2,000 women conducted by one poll, who else, on behalf of... Go on, guess. No, I'll wait. Go on. Okay, did any of you say goo puds? If so, give yourself a chocolatey treat. Apparently, you'll feel good about it. To launch their Give In to Temptation ad campaign, Goo Puds commissioned a survey which somehow came up with the astonishingly convenient conclusion that giving in to temptation when it comes to chocolate, like, for example, the chocolate on top of their puddings, who knew, is good for you. Amazing. So, I guess the reason I've not done one of these reports in a while is that sometimes it's just so fucking easy to see through this nonsense that I'm worried you'll all just get so bored you'll skip ahead. So, instead, I'm going to try something of a different approach. Instead of telling you what was in this week's Daily Mail, I'm going to try and tell you what will be in next week's Daily Mail, or one of the weeks coming up. I'll give you a couple of examples and we'll see how we do. No promises here, this is purely speculative, going out on a limb stuff. So, first of all, I reckon there'll be a story declaring how women gossip a lot more than men, and that their favourite gossiping topics are a certain footballer, whose name may be bleeped if I were to say it, Cheryl Cole, Britain's Got Talent, and probably the Royal Wedding. I even suspect it'll find that women spend something crazy like 20 days a year just gossiping, or 500 hours a year just engaging in gossip. That's a prediction. At the same time, I also think we'll see a story about how kids these days never get a chance to play outdoors. They live too far away from forests and woods and parks and rivers and all that good stuff because of their city life. And I think it'll even have the headline going along the lines that free-range chickens have more freedom to roam than the average child. Another prediction, a story I think might appear, is the shock revelation that most of Britain doesn't know who's on the back of a £10 note, doesn't know that it's Charles Darwin, and that they don't care, and that they'd far rather see the likes of Pippa Middleton, Stephen Fry, or that weird kid who was in Harry Potter and was the star of the Twilight films. They'd rather have one of those three on the back of our tenors. And finally, I'd like to lay good money that the Daily Mail next week, probably even near the back of next week, will tell us that working dads these days have it harder than men ever have in the past. That they're underappreciated by their partners, that Father's Day are the only day each year that they actually get to be spoiled themselves, and that, by the way, aftershave really does smell rather nice on a man. Now, none of these are hard and fast, and if none of them come up in the next couple of weeks, then I urge you not to pour scorn on me and spit on me in the street as I walk by for wasting your valuable Pod Delusion time. But I think there's a decent chance that at least a couple of these will appear in the near future. And if they do come up, remember where you heard it first. So this has been Michael Marshall taking a wild, speculative and almost certain to backfire punt on upcoming bad news for the Pod Delusion. And that's it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can find videos of the protesters invading the Richard Dawkins event, a podcast of the Richard Dawkins and PZ Myers event itself, as well as listen to older episodes, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and do loads of other exciting things. You can even buy Pod Delusion t-shirts, badges, mugs and caps, if you're into that sort of thing. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Liz Luckendorf, Pete Haig, Drew Ray, Sven Rudloff, James Thomas, Michael Marshall, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf.
The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. In a moment, you'll be hearing a short sketch by David Lovesey at TLC Creative. Thanks for listening.
Here. I've got the family out, but the goldfish is still inside.
Don't worry, Mr. Salisbury. We'll soon have that fire under control.
Coming here on a bicycle is a good idea. I assume the fire engine is on its way through the traffic?
Just me today, Mr. Salisbury. Be done in a jiffy.
What? Well, where's your hose?
I don't need one, sir. I'm the town's fully trained alternative fire service.
Alternative?
Fire service, yes. We take a homeopathic approach to conflagration dispersal. Well, see here, I've got this small damp flannel, which I will throw thusly into the heart of the inferno.
And?
Well, that's it, Mr. Salisbury. There's a trace memory of water within the flannel as effective as 10,000 litres of pump water. That's the homeopathic way.
You bloody idiot! That's not going to make any difference and my house is going to burn down!
It's a very close-minded view, sir. One flannel applied daily over the next 3 months will see that fire gone completely.
3 months? Of course it'll be gone completely. My home will be ashes in the morning.
Only if you take the scientifically accurate view on the situation, sir. Homeopathy requires a bit more faith and trust.
Really? Well, officer, in that case, I trust that you will enjoy this swift knee to your groin.
Oh! Oh, dear, sir. You seem to have misaligned my chakras.